It gets angry at people like Molly. It gets angry at Julie Kelly, who's the only person really tirelessly chronicling the dramatic injustice that's being dealt out to the January 6th protesters. Or Heather McDonald, who chronicles the complete collapse of law and order in our cities. It gets mad at those people. Why are you rocking the boat? Now, conservatives, I've been complaining about this for a long time. I'll reiterate the complaint. A lot of conservatives, I think, believe that the most noble thing they can do is to police their own side. The left never does this, ever. The left works overtime to ensure that its people are excused, exonerated, set free, bailed out on charges of murder, rioting, arson, you name it. Meanwhile, the conservatives eagerly seek the death penalty for their own side over parking tickets. Not that I'm saying we should be like the left. I think we should be a little. We ought to be more loyal to our friends and our people. I am not saying that we should excuse arson and rioting, but that's a moot point anyway, since our side doesn't riot and burn down cities. So we don't really have to worry about that dilemma confronting us anytime soon. For conservatives, the most heroic act of the 20th century was not D-Day or the moon landing. It was Buckley purging the Birchers. And they're always on the lookout for more purges. Whole careers and institutions are now made of this. Think of the Bulwark and the Dispatch and the billions of dollars, or however much it is, behind them, of Bill and Steve and Jonah and David and Kevin. All of them now character assassins out to destroy the lives of anyone even a click to their right. One thing I've also noticed is that conservatives really get mad when you point out that the people who treat you like enemies are, in fact, your enemies. Finally, the conservatives find a backbone and some righteous indignation. To refer to someone libeling you, trying to cancel you, calling for your, quote, extirpation and assassination, I use those words advisedly since they both happened to me, if you describe that person as an enemy, how dare you? You're being uncivil. Civility in politics above all else. You're raising the temperature. Right? What explains this? I think it's kind of perverse, so let's see if we can find an explanation. Let me give you another quote, this one from a movie. I'll do my best Robert De Niro impersonation here. Probably won't be that good, but it'll give you the flavor of the quote. He says, "I'm sorry, but he knew about our getting hit on three big machines in a row, and he did nothing about it. That means either he was in on it, or forgive me for saying this, he was too dumb to see what was going on. Either way, I cannot have a man like that working here." The operative phrase here being in on it, i.e. part of the operation to ensure that the right is forever feckless and useless, and to destroy anyone on the right who scores real points against our anti-conservative, anti-liberal, anti-American, and, brace yourselves, I'm just going to say it, increasingly anti-white regime. Actually, this is what gets the conservatives most upset. Noticing that the regime is all of the above, quoting the left's own radical words back makes conservatives apoplectic. Not with rage, exactly. I don't think they have enough thumos for genuine rage. But with a kind of terror. Oh no, he said it. Now they'll really get mad. Let's not rock the boat. Peace above all. To appease this God we have just angered, it's time for another sacrifice on the altar of Concord. Let's see which rightist we can disembowel next. Either way, either they're in on it, or they're motivated by a dedication to principles so perverse as to be self-negating. It is plausible, and we may say that the explanation fits the observable facts, that the conservatives are the way they are because they have completely internalized the narrative of the left. They believe America is irredeemably evil and racist. They believe that they themselves are horrible people, burdened with a kind of original sin, but not the one described in the Bible, but rather one cooked up by 20th century academic leftists and intellectuals. They believe, to quote Susan Sontag, her most famous quote, maybe her only memorable quote, that the white race is the cancer of human history. And so they believe they deserve to lose, and perhaps even to deserve to die. So let me return to our stated topic here. To the extent that the modern conservative takes his, quote, principles seriously, he must oppose the founding principles, which are not conceivable absent the American Revolution. But he has to oppose the revolution with its friend-enemy distinction, its radicalism, its instability and incivility, its, let's be blunt, its violence. Plus, of course, it's, you know, we don't need to add, but we will, right? It's racism, sexism, classism, and there were no transgender bathrooms at Independence Hall. I would submit to you, if a modern conservative takes his stated principles seriously, it's ridiculous for him to profess admiration of George Washington. He has to admire a statue of a George Washington that doesn't exist, or his imagination of a George Washington, not the actual real George Washington, who did the things that the history books record, assuming you can still find them available in a library, unburnt. Now, in the speech I referenced earlier, Joe Biden said, quote, "There is no place for political violence in America, period, none, ever," unquote. Leave aside the fact that his team commits such violence almost daily with impunity, and his side works hard to excuse it and make sure there's plenty of bail money to get everybody out of jail, and lawyers to make sure that they get off with get the charges dismissed or suspended sentences. Leave that aside. As a historical and theoretical matter, that statement is complete garbage, right? Violence birthed America. It's just a fact. Now, it was justified violence. It was organized violence. It was careful violence. It was the furthest thing from indiscriminate, okay? But it was still a war waged against a government that considered itself legitimate. Now, all governments consider themselves legitimate. The worst tyrants never concede for an instant that they are anything but ordained by God. Or, if we're talking about an atheist tyrant, a Stalin or a Lenin, by some kind of natural order or history. That only means, though, that anyone looking to invoke the right of revolution, in practice, had better carefully think through the circumstances. Know that he is not just right theoretically, but that it is prudent to pursue in the here and now, i.e., that he can win and do better than the present regime. Another quote, this one you'll remember, and I won't need to tell you what document it's from, it should be obvious. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. Conservatives, who should know better, reject all this, at least implicitly. They study the revolution as, at best, a historical curiosity. They claim not to be historicists, at least those who know what historicism is deny that designation for themselves, but I believe and will argue and submit that they are all, in fact, Hegelians, whether they admit it to themselves or not. I would submit further that they all owe Francis Fukuyama a huge apology. Everybody remember who he is? These days, he's a kind of, it's hard to say what he is, he's an ex-neocon, current liberal who wants the United States to get involved in the war and nuke Russia or something. I don't know, he's kind of gone crazy. But you could argue he was always crazy. Anyway, he became famous, very famous in 1989 for declaring the, quote, end of history. Big article. You should all be so lucky as to write an article that gets that much attention, even if it's dumb. The fame is probably intoxicating and it can get you a book contract, which it did in his case. But the conservatives laughed at that, I think rightly. Every time some new event happened, they would say, oh ho, how is that possible? We thought it was the end of history. Ha ha, Frank. Right? Conservatives have actually been giving that same joke for 30 years now. Well, these days, if you even suggest that the United States might be trending in a bad direction, here come the conservative enforcers. It's not merely that they think our constitutional system is or ought to be sacrosanct. On that, I completely agree with them. It's that they believe, against the founders and against all experience of history, that once implemented, it can never be lost. They defend every perversion, distortion, corruption, and topsy-turvy reinterpretation of that system as if it were the system itself. Do they not see the change? Do they see it but not favor it? Or do they see it but favor it? I'm sorry. In any case, they lie about it, in my opinion. They deny that the change has happened or is happening, the better to lull those who might otherwise worry into somnambulant silence. And then they praise that it's happening because it's all to the good. I guess that's how they stay in the good graces of the left. But if historicism is false, then the American system can be lost. Tyranny can recur. Remember George W. Bush's second inaugural. The purpose of the United States henceforth was dedicated to ending tyranny in our world. A preposterous, utopian, impossible thing to accomplish. Okay? A conservative should regard that, I think, as a utopian and impossible. But ours don't. It's funny, a consistent theme of the left over my lifetime has been it can happen here. The it, of course, being the United States becoming a Nazi state. Left's been saying this forever. Whole movies are made about it. I never watched them, but I know they exist because you can't get away from the promotional materials. You know, The Man in the High Castle or Philip Roth's The Plot Against America. I mean, they do the same movie over and over again, The Dark Knight of Fascism descending on the United States. The USA in the leftist imagination is always 1 millimeter away from Hitler or some new Hitler. But conservatives have their own version of this. It can't happen here. Human possibilities that have bedeviled the world since there have been human beings not merely will never recur here, they can't recur here. We're somehow immune. Now, personally, you can guess what I think of that. I think it's ridiculous as a matter of theory and history and conservative and observable experience. So returning again to the beginning, what do the founding principles require of us today? I would say first they require an honest assessment of where we are, of the present regime. Let's do, for instance, an honest reading of the 18 charges against George III, with which the Declaration of Independence almost concludes. There's still two paragraphs after that, but, and compare them to our situation. Second, once we have a clear-eyed grasp of our situation, the founding principles require us to deliberate on what to do. And here's where the conservatives lose their cookies. I've seen this happen a number of times, including only just last week to a friend and colleague of mine. You bring up the right of revolution as even a theoretical matter, even state that it has to be metaphysically true, or just state that the founders believed it, and the conservative will scream, "Oh ho, what do you mean what to do? You calling for armed revolution right now?" And then they get on their cell phone, "Director Ray, I got one, he's here in the room right now. Come get the insurrectionist. I know you guys have had a hard time finding people who really want armed rebellion against the USA, right? I got a live one right now." By the way, that gets me some points, right? So rather than play along with the conservative desire to get me to, as the kids call it, Fed post, so that I can be served up to the security state, I'd rather turn it around. I have a question for the conservatives, actually several, which I know they won't answer, which means it's really for you, the audience, to ponder. Is the right of revolution ever justified? Was it justified only that one time in 1776, but never again? If so, why was it justified then, and what makes it unjustifiable ever again? Because of historicism? Was the American Revolution an irreversible leap into a future that can't go dark, that can't go bad, can't go backward? Or is it that you think things can't ever get bad enough in this country, or merely that they won't? I.e., is there some deep structural reason, or is it merely your expectation? If the latter, then you are implicitly admitting, in theory, that the right of revolution might at some point be justified, i.e., it has not been obviated by history. Now, we should all hope that this remains merely a theoretical discussion. And in terms of that discussion, I maintain that theoretical discussion, I make clear, I maintain it as axiomatic that you can't have natural rights without a right of revolution, just as you can't have the founding without an actual revolution. And you can't have since you can't have the American regime without natural rights, then you can't have natural rights or the American regime without a right of revolution. You take any one of these things away, the whole system crashes. It collapses in its own contradiction and incoherence. But on a practical level, my last question, because Richard is looking at me with the hook, what does the denial of this right, if we are to deny it, force us to do, to accept anything and everything? Where are the limits? You know, while evils are sufferable, implies that there will come a time when evils are no longer sufferable. Are all evils sufferable forever? Are we required to suffer them? Now, we know from Scripture that we're required to suffer certain evils that God ordains for us, but God doesn't say that you're ordained or required to endure certain human-inflicted evils for all time and do nothing, right? The implicit and sometimes explicit conservative answer appears to be, yes, we're required to suffer forever. Turn the other cheek, bend the knee, endure your beatings forever. For if there is no recourse to a higher principle or law, then there is no other choice. That is, to borrow from Machiavelli, the, quote, effectual truth, unquote, of conservative pusillanimity, another of his favorite words and mine, about the right of revolution, is perpetual self-subjugation to tyranny. Weasels, compromisers, mediocrities, and losers, indeed. Again, that's a quote. I like it, but it's a quote from someone else. But to be fair, the conservatives can muster strength when they see a real threat to their position. You can be sure that if you so much as glancingly wonder if the right of revolution exists even in theory, their conservative will be armed and ready to shoot you in the back. Thank you.
Before I begin, just a quick word to any graduate students or recent PhDs in this room. If any of you are interested in a postdoc with me at Clemson University, please come and see me sometime after this event. I'd like to begin by considering the animating theme of this conference. The general theme of the conference is, can American institutions still be conserved? And the theme of this panel is what does fidelity to our founding principles require today? If I'm being honest, my answer to the first question is maybe, perhaps, hopefully. But it's hard to be much more positive than that. To paraphrase that famous line from Hungarian communists in the 1950s, situation hopeless, not yet bad. It is the job of conservatives, classical liberals, and even libertarians to conserve that which represents the best of our intellectual, cultural, and political traditions. Sometimes, however, conservatives are prone to invoke the Jeremiad, a literary form that is most often presented as a lament, an exhortation, and a calling, a lament for things lost, an exhortation to recover what is true, good, and beautiful about our society's manners and mores, and a calling to come home. The American tradition of the Jeremiad began with the first generation Puritans in the 1650s as they assessed the vices of their children and grandchildren. The American Jeremiad tells the story of declension, decay, and disintegration. The Jeremiad, broadly understood, is not, though, a uniquely American tradition. Instead, it seems to be a timeless and universal tradition for cranky old men. From John Winthrop and Cotton Mather to Russell Kirk and Junior Soprano, old men like to lament the manners and mores of their progeny. For all of the hand-wringing associated with the Jeremiad, it does serve, though, I think, a useful function in society. It serves as a remembrance of things past, certainly of the good and sometimes even of the bad and ugly as cautionary tales. The one obvious problem, though, with the Jeremiad is that it can become predictable, stale, and boring, certainly to the young, which is the cause of their perpetual eye-rolling. My talk today is a kind of Jeremiad, but with a twist. By any objective measurement, we now live in a country that can be described as one of the most immoral in world history. Let me share with you a few examples chosen from all too many. We now live in a country whose ruling class openly and embraces and rejoices in the mental and physical mutilation of its children. We live in a country where it is now okay for mothers to have their 8-year-old sons participate in drag queen events, to put them on body-changing and life-altering drugs, to prepare them for surgeries, to remove their sex organs, and to deny the rights of fathers to object to this evil. We now live in a country where the government school system requires young children to read pedophilic books such as Gender Queer, which depicts a young boy performing fellatio on an older man. We now live in a country where frontline soldiers are forced by their military commanders to use reality-defying and truth-denying gender-neutral pronouns. I could go on and on. But a life of futile pessimism is not much of a life. And so we are directed to the question assigned for this panel. And my answer to it is twofold. First, fidelity means that we must actually be true to the founding principles. And second, we must fight. We must fight to preserve those principles. Now, obviously, these answers are too simple, if not simple-minded. We need more. What does it mean to be true to America's founding principles? First and foremost, it means that we must understand, champion, and defend those principles from all enemies, foreign and domestic. As I'm sure all of you know, the founders' principles have been under attack from the progressive left for 130 years or so. In more recent years, however, some on what we might call the reactionary right have also judged and condemned America's founding principles as either irrelevant to the needs of the 21st century or as the source of the maladies that afflict us. So, what does it mean to fight? It means that we need to know why we should fight, what we are fighting for, and how we should fight. Why do we fight? The why question is the simplest to answer. We must fight as an act of devotion to those we love, to our parents, spouses, children, friends, neighbors, and fellow citizens. And we must fight to save the country we love. We must also accept as a moral obligation the responsibility to fight for those things that our forebears fought, namely freedom. The freedom that was institutionalized during our revolutionary founding period. Men without chests do not deserve their freedom. This means that we must reject the politics of compromise and cowardice, but it also means that we must likewise reject the politics of despair, and with it the politics of nihilism that some on the right have turned to in recent years. Simply put, we must resist the temptation to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I assume, or at least I hope, that the members of the Philadelphia Society can at least agree with me on that. The more difficult questions to answer are the what and the how questions. What are we fighting for? What is it that we seek to preserve? The mission of the Philadelphia Society is, in part, to preserve the principles and institutions on which this country was founded. We defend them not simply because they are ours and not simply as an exercise in filial pietism. Rather, we defend them because they are true. And that's the rub. How do we defend the truth of the founders' principles when it is said that we live in a post-truth world? A world in which we are now supposed to refer to men as she, her, and hers, or as I, Zim, and Zir. When we speak of those principles and institutions to which we owe fidelity, the quickest and easiest way, I think, to sum them up is to defer to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The writers and signers of the Declaration spoke not so much of principles, but of truths, moral and political truths. Truths they considered to be absolute, inalienable, universal, and permanent. Presumably those truths are as true today as they were in 1776, and thus they are still worth defending. The Declaration lists four truths, each of which can be summed up with a single word: equality, rights, consent, and revolution. The least discussed of the Declaration's four truths is probably the fourth, the right to revolution. The Declaration's revolution truth says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Built into the heart and soul of American conservatism is the revolution truth, which says that the people have a right to alter or abolish their government if it repeatedly denies or destroys the individual rights of the people, that is, the rights to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, and a series of corollary civil rights. In other words, it is conservatives and classical liberals who must conserve the revolution truth. The Declaration's revolution truth is borrowed from John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. Locke's goal was to establish objective criteria for judging when subjects or citizens are justified in resisting or rebelling against the laws and actions of their rulers. Locke's first criterion concerns when the legislative is altered, his language, which includes, one, when a ruler arbitrarily alters the electors or ways of election. And two, when a ruler delivers his subjects or citizens into the subjection of a foreign power. Locke's second criterion, sanctioning revolution, arises when rulers act contrary to their trust. Governments that repeatedly violate the fundamental rights of their citizens not only deserve no respect or allegiance, but they are in fact criminal institutions that must be overturned. And I will leave it to your imaginations to determine whether Locke's criteria are relevant in the context of 2022. For now, though, let's fast forward to 1776. The Declaration's right to revolution indicates the conditions under which revolution is justified, whereas the rights to life or liberty are simply absolute, the right to revolution is contextually absolute, which means its application is context-dependent. Interestingly, the fourth truth is prudence, which is the practical virtue determining when revolution is both justified and propitious. According to the Declaration, prudence dictates that revolution must be the last resort of the people against rights-violating governments. There are times when exercising the right to revolution would, in fact, be imprudent or foolhardy, even though the people might be justified in doing so. Determining why, when, and how government should be altered or abolished is a complicated question, both in theory and practice. The Declaration identifies the challenge as twofold. First, governments with long and venerable histories should not be changed for light and transient causes. Second, history teaches that men, and I'm quoting the Declaration, are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. The question of timing is therefore critical to the founders' theory of revolution. The question raised by the Declaration is, when exactly is revolution both justified and prudent? The first thing to note is that one act of injustice or tyranny by the government does not justify revolution. There must be, according to the Declaration, a long train of abuses and usurpations, and a settled design to reduce them under absolute despotism. Having reached that point, the people have, the Declaration says, both a right and a duty to throw off such government. Fast forward now to 2022. Ask yourself these two questions. Do the criteria established by Locke in the Declaration apply to contemporary America? Are the American people freer or less free today than the American colonists of 1776? In thinking through the implications of these questions, the first thing to note is that the context of today is completely different than it was in 1776. And it's also important to note that the criteria used by Locke and American revolutionaries are not the only criteria to determine whether revolution is justified or how to do it. Remember, the right to revolution is contextual and contexts change, and those facts are particularly relevant to the prudence question. Consider two concrete examples. First, Locke and Jefferson claim that revolution is justified if the legislature is altered. Ask yourself this question. Has the administrative state changed the nature of our constitutional republic? Second, Locke and Jefferson claim that revolution is justified when rulers act contrary to their trust, which is to protect the rights of their citizens. Ask yourself this question. How many laws passed by the federal government since the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 have violated the rights of American citizens? Now, these are all interesting theoretical questions. And let's say, hypothetically speaking, that our government has become a soft despotism with a clear design to become a hard despotism. And again, hypothetically asking, how should the American people respond to this state of affairs? Quoting Comrade Lenin, what is to be done? And this takes me to my final question. How should we fight in 2022? Let's begin with the obvious. 2022 is not 1776. The source of our despotism is not 3,000 miles away. It is here, it is now, it is everywhere. It can be felt, but it is largely unseen. The deep state is deeper than any of us know. We see only a fraction of its size, power, and influence. This means that 1776, as a matter of prudence, cannot be a model for today. Revolutions, though, come in many different forms. Armed rebellion, for instance, is not a necessary condition for revolution. There can be what we might call a velvet or a silk revolution. There can be invisible revolutions that transform a nation over the course of decades. This much I know. A 21st century revolution must be a nonviolent, bottom-up revolution. It will be largely a leaderless revolution. To borrow and flip a concept from the cultural left, it will come in the form of a long march away from the institutions. The revolution, therefore, will be mostly a quiet revolution, an underground revolution, a samizdat revolution. We shall follow the path explained so brilliantly in Václav Havel's indispensable essay, The Power of the Powerless. We need millions of Havel's green grocers who will say, no, I will not tell a lie. I will no longer sanction evil. I must live in the truth. Still, we must act. There are things that can and must be done. First, we must identify those institutions that are vulnerable to capture, to being altered, or better yet, to being abolished. Here's an idea. It turns out that the single most immoral institution in the United States, the one that has done the most damage to America, the one that is the embodiment of despotism, is also the one that is most vulnerable to not only being altered, but to being abolished. And that is America's K-12 government school system. But how do we abolish an institution so deeply ingrained in American culture? The answer is simple. We withdraw our sanction. That's it. To that end, I've dedicated my public writings in recent years, both at my Substack, The Redneck Intellectual, and at my website, edwatchdaily.com, to encouraging what I call the hashtag Just Walk Away movement. And the good news is that the Just Walk Away movement is happening without the Republican Party and without the DC think tank establishment. In fact, it's happening, ironically enough, because of COVID and of the utter stupidity of the education deep state. The COVID lockdowns promoted by the education establishment sent tens of millions of children home for over a year and a half to be miseducated online, where parents could see and hear for the first time ever what their children were actually learning or not learning in the government schools, and they were shocked and horrified. They learned that their kids were being indoctrinated in critical race and gender theory. They learned that the schools were actually grooming minor age children to transition to the opposite sex via life-altering puberty blockers, hormone therapies, and genital mutilation. And all of this they tried to keep secret from their parents. And we all know the result. Over the course of the last 2 years, a large group of American mothers, and if the revolution is to have leaders, it will be the mothers of America, who have now been designated by the Justice Department and the FBI as domestic terrorists. They were radicalized. America's mothers were radicalized, and they began protesting at local school board meetings all over the United States. More importantly, millions of American families joined the Just Walk Away movement, and they have pulled their kids from the government schools. Many of those families are now homeschooling, some are going to private and charter schools, and others are creating micro schools and education pods. This is the great exodus. As a result, the government schools are imploding. Students and teachers are leaving in droves. The system cannot be sustained, and it must not be reformed. We must, therefore, support the principle of separation of school and state. Which means that we must be abolitionists. So, how do we get from here to there? Here's a back-of-the-envelope five-step program for abolishing the government school system, and I'll be very quick, Richard. We must, one, delegitimize the government schools, not only as failing in practice, but as immoral. Two, encourage ordinary Americans to just walk away. Three, rescind all laws regulating homeschools and the creation of micro-schools and education pods. Four, we must require all Republican politicians to pledge they will support abolishing the Federal Department of Education and its 50 state surrogates. And five, we must take whatever steps necessary to decertify the so-called education schools. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the revolution. And the leaders of the revolution are ordinary Americans. This movement will not be stopped, and the revolution will not be televised. We have a critical mass, and there is no going back. Dusk is approaching, and the owl of Minerva will soon spread its wings. And so, all of you sitting here today, you have a choice. Either you join us, or you get the hell out of the way. This is a warning. If you are a conservative who wants to reform the government school system, know this. You are at best irrelevant. At worst, you are a loyalist. You are a loyalist to the regime, a loyalist to the government school system, a loyalist to the single most immoral institution in America. And you should be ashamed. Thank you.
I would invite you to, for the next 10 minutes, to respond as you will to each other's presentations before we go to Q&A.
I don't know that I have anything to start off, but I can respond to a response if need be.
Sure.
And I guess I would say the same. I've never met Michael Anton before, and therefore I had no idea what he was going to be saying today, but I thought there was some symmetry between your remarks and mine.
Okay, I'm happy if you know, the more people who can recognize at a minimum the theoretical necessity of the right of revolution to the founders' conception of natural rights and to their regime, the better. So I'd like that opinion to become universal on the so-called right. It will never be because this is, the world's imperfect. What are you going to do? But that's my goal. Just as George Bush wanted to end tyranny in our world, I have set a slightly less lofty goal. I just want to convince a couple of thousand conservative intellectuals that the right of revolution is an integral part of the American founding and can't be removed without crashing the entire edifice to the ground. If I have done that, I don't know, that'll have been a decent thing to have done.
And I guess I would just then add to that that I've been, you know, in the conservative, classical, liberal, libertarian world, the liberty movements for several decades now. And it seemed to me that for all of that time, these groups were looking at the state of America from the macro level. And all of their solutions were at the macro level. And I can just tell you that in the context of my life, I have decided that that is the road to nowhere. It's the road to failure. It's just, you know, another meeting of like-minded people complaining and whining about the state of America and offering these glittering generalities as responses to the state of the world. And in my own case, I've made the determination that the way to actually make a real difference in the world, even if it's just a small difference in the world, is to identify a single issue and dedicate all of your time and attention to making a real difference on that one issue. So there's a young man named Alex Epstein who has mastered the debates over energy and has become America's, I think, leading expert on energy and fighting for free markets in energy. And in my own small and modest way, just in the course of the last year, really, have decided to dedicate myself to the K-12 education issue. And in the context of what I'm trying to do, at least, I will say that the only thing I've really done is to catch a wave, right? It was the identification of the fact that that on the ground, on the surface level, that there was a kind of underground movement of ordinary, everyday Americans, mothers in particular, who were leading the charge. And in the last year, I've been writing a lot on the K-12 education issue, but really mostly just in the service of what tens of thousands of American mothers are doing around the country. And I think that sometimes we need to see movements that are developing spontaneously on their own and try and give them a little support.
So I guess I'd say one more thing, Richard, which is if I take what Professor Thompson, if I understand him correctly, he's arguing for a kind of, maybe passive resistance is too weak a way to describe it. There's a certain amount of activity involved, but it's also a certain type of activity that's more passive than active, if you follow me, right? So I'm reminded of Gandhi and how he got the British to leave India over a struggle of some dozen or more years, right? And it worked in his case because, for a number of reasons, because the population of India was so enormous, I don't know what it was at that time, but already something like 500 or 600 million, because the Raj, the British regime, was very small, very thin on the ground. It didn't have a lot of resources. It could only govern the subcontinent and that large a population with its effective acquiescence and consent. And once that was withdrawn, even in a passive way, the Raj becomes impossible. And we're talking about 1947, when the Brits are completely broke from the war, exhausted, and when the very idea of colonialism itself has been totally stripped of its legitimacy. So it turned out to be, I don't want to say an easy thing, but it turned out to be at least possible to use that strategy. And just there's a great scene in the Richard Attenborough 1982 movie where Gandhi, played by Ben Kingsley, says to someone, I forgot which British official, but some senior British official, he says, you know, you will leave. And I says, you think we're just going to leave? And Gandhi says, yes, you will leave. And in the end, he was right. They just left. But what happens if trying that strategy here, and I'm not saying this will happen, I'm saying that you got to think about the possibility. It is certainly a fact that the regime that runs the present United States of America in an anti-constitutional way is a heck of a lot larger, stronger, more numerous, more powerful, richer, has greater tools, technological, security, other tools that the British Raj did not have in 1947, and so is probably in a far stronger position to react against any kind of passive resistance or any kind of active resistance up to a certain point, and won't take kindly. It's not going to just let you go, right? It's not going to just say, well, yeah, I guess you don't like this anymore, so that's cool, but keep in touch, we'll talk. I think it's at least as likely that it'll say no. You know, we're going to make sure that we keep a lid on this thing, and we keep the control over you that we have spent a couple generations in establishing, we wish to maintain, and we think it's legitimate and you are wrong, and we will be justified. I mean, look at the things they already think that they're justified in doing that flatly contradict any historical or just demonstrable, read the documents, understanding of American liberties. They do these things now as a matter of course, and they think they're justified. I don't know that they're necessarily going to let us go in an amicable or even bitter but uncontentious manner. And then what? Right? Well, if the right under discussion has any meaning, it means that you might have to have recourse to some other means, whatever that means is. Or, and let's be clear, I'm just saying, well, I just want to establish theoretical clarity here. Or it means you submit. And that submission could take the form of prudence. Well, we're submitting not because we think it's right, but because we just don't see any other way out, and the attempt will fail and make everything worse. Right? That I can understand and even get behind if that's actually the circumstance. What I do reject as a theoretical matter, at a minimum, is the notion that we're submitting because we're obligated to, or because this is the best of all possible worlds, or because the revolution once accomplished is a permanent thing and can never be corrupted or conquered for within, nor can the state machinery be perverted and used against us. I think that's all of that is false and proven false in operation every day, and the more honest we are with ourselves about that, the better, and the better assessment of our situation we will come to, the more accurate assessment we will come to.
Of one thing I am certain, America's homeschool mothers will not submit.
All right, I will open it up for Q&A and also have the questions on Slido. I wanted to ask one question. I agree with much of what both of you have said regarding the problems in our regime, the constitutional problems. I was thinking about the Declaration. We've got 27 grievances in the Declaration of Independence.
Well, 18, but then one of them is sort of broken out into subcategories, but depending on how you count.
Okay, well, fine. Thinking about these categories and, you know, abolish laws, prevent self-government, military over civil law, colonists being tried in a foreign location, taxation, consent of the governed being abolished, preventing the legislatures from meeting, and then, you know, the king placing the colonist outside of his protection, opening it up to predation by Indians, things like this, the Quebec government, et cetera, et cetera. We think of those 27 grievances, to me that's what actually grounds or gives the Natural Rights Proclamation, the second paragraph, something that is concrete and then embodied in the life of the colonist. And I was just thinking about our present situation. Should we sort of interweave these categories into how we're thinking contextually? If so, how do they apply? And also I was just thinking, I mean, as an earlier panelist said, conservatives do win a lot of elections. Hold state legislatures. Even the 2020 election did fairly well. Do we find that condition, the fact that we do seem to win elections at least half the time, conducive to a ride of revolution or calling for a ride of revolution, if in fact we are succeeding politically at some level?
Well, I mean, first of all, as to the Declaration, you know, some of the charges, it's contextual, are not exactly apt to what we're talking about today. Like, there's no quartering of troops. They haven't resorted to that yet. We'll see. We'll see if that becomes a thing later on. Some of them do seem apt and somewhat familiar. And again, I'd say it's incumbent upon all of us to examine what was going on then and examine going on today. And, you know, first of all, we need to each come to our own individual judgment about where we think it is, and then we need to have a debate about it. And I think the debate about it gets constrained by the immediate sort of, you know, denunciation that people to the right have against those on their own side who they think are going outside the lines a little bit. And that's not helpful, doesn't it? It's not helpful. It constrains what we're able to think in a way that will ultimately constrain us coming up with a prudent course of action. As to conservatives winning elections, yeah, they do. My complaint about the conservatives winning elections is they often don't do much with them. I'm sort of sympathetic with them at the federal level because it's hard to do anything at the federal level because the permanent bureaucracy won't let you. Even if you could get your leadership, and I talk to senators and members of Congress sometimes who I think have great ideas and really want to do good things. And then they say, well, you know, I can't get that past McCarthy or McConnell or whatever. And they're not, I don't think they're saying that as a cop-out, right? They're genuinely upset that the leadership has all this power and uses it to bottle up reforms that would be helpful. And I sort of sympathize with that too, and I don't know what to tell them. So I'm more disappointed in the conservatives that win statewide with big legislative majorities and have governors, and they don't do anything with it, or they do dumb things, like Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas completely signing on to all the transgender madness and other stuff in his last year because he knows that the Walmart board wants him to. Now, luckily, the conservatives here, I'm going to backtrack on my own argument, the conservative state legislature overrode his veto, so God bless. But think of, you know, Kristi Noem caving to them in the same way. I mean, it's very disappointing, and I don't, there's no, where's the excuse for that other than a lack of conviction? So I'd like to see better conservatives win elections at the state, bolder conservatives, more willing to exercise state power, and more willing to get into fights, you know, legislative fights, legal fights, political fights, to be clear, with the federal government. But again, if the states were to start to really assert their sovereignty over those issues, which the federal constitution nominally leaves to them, but in practice today leaves them no space at all, free from federal supervision, the feds are not going to take that lightly or lying down. And the conservative movement needs to be prepared for that and have a plan or have some kind of thought and strategy about how to deal with it, and certainly not revert to, well, you know, there's nothing you can do, or the courts have decided, I guess that's unconstitutional or whatever. And I don't see yet that fighting spirit, which I think is going to need to be. I see only the beginnings of it. It's a little better than it was a few years ago, but it's going to have to get a lot better if the states are going to be useful vehicles for resisting federal encroachment and, dare I say, you know, federal mandated federal tyranny. When they just come in and say that because of this administrative rule, you're going to do that, and that's the end of that. I want to see more states be willing to stand up for that kind of thing and suffer, you know, some political and perhaps even economic consequences for doing so. And I don't see the willingness for them to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, Joe Sullivan from Dallas. I'm a business and financial consultant, and I specialize in difficult transitions and bankrupt and dysfunctional organizations. And if I don't have concrete, actionable proposals for my clients at work, they stop calling me and I have to trim my budget radically. So I like Bradley Thompson's focus here on walking away from the education establishment, in part because I am married to a homeschool mother and I am the father of one. Now, let me add a couple of things. I'll do it with an up inflection to make it into a question, and I would like your response. But there are two or three things that are critical in this that we've learned, absolutely critical in this that we've learned. One is, whatever the state is, and we're blessed to be in Texas, it has to be fully legal to homeschool your children. The teachers' unions go to a lot of trouble to see to it that it isn't. The second thing is, if legal, it must also not be regulated. A lot of people, including our crowd, say, oh my gosh, some of these parents are ignoramuses, bad things will happen, and it's all true. But bad things happen, and worse things, in the school system. When it's regulated, the educational authorities use that as a way to choke out homeschooling, and I could give lots of detail. The third thing, which I just learned about, and my daughter may still be in the room. Are you in the room, Lydia? Yeah. She could tell you the details, but she's now in West Virginia, and in West Virginia, they actually provide school funding to homeschooling families. Now, these are three concrete things that everybody can go home and talk up and say, hey, look, this is great. Homeschooling needs to be legal. It needs not to be regulated because the regulation is an alternative way to stifle it. And the third thing is there are places where they're successfully applying funding, sharing the funding with homeschoolers. To make it a question, what do you think of that?
I like one, two, but I don't like three. So I support legalizing homeschooling, which ought not to be have to be legalized in the first place, but Homeschooling should be entirely legalized. There should be no, I don't support any regulations for homeschooling at all, but I do not support the government in any way funding homeschooling parents. And the reason I don't is obvious, because wherever government money goes, government goes. And wherever government goes, government regulations come. And the one thing that cannot and must not ever happen is for homeschooling to be regulated in any way, shape, or form. So, and, you know, and which is why, for instance, even though I did have one passing reference to charter schools, in the end, when push comes to shove, I'm not a supporter of charter schools for the very same reason, or for vouchers. I support a complete separation of school and state. If you do not want the government regulating Sunday school, why would you want the government regulating school Monday through Friday? I want government out, period. I want a free market of education.
I don't know. I guess I'd be more sympathetic to the possibility. To me, it's not the principle of government funding it. It's which government and to what end, right? I mean, we used to have pretty strong public schools throughout this country that taught patriotic civics education, the sound fundamentals in reading, writing, arithmetic, and good morality, and began every day with a prayer. So all paid for by taxpayers. That proves that it's possible. It's obviously not possible with the government that we have now, but maybe it's possible at the state level, where you look to other countries where, you know, the Hungarians, for instance, are putting a lot of money into education. I don't know that the answer is a permanent cleavage between government and education so much as it is the problem is with the nature and type of a government that we have now. I'd rather just have a better government whose aim was the uplift and improvement of its citizens rather than whatever the aim of the current government is, let's say the taxation and despoilation of its citizens. And then if I had the former rather than the latter, I'd probably be encouraging that government to get more involved in education, especially since these poor homeschoolers are all paying taxes for a public school that they're not using. So, you know, getting a little of that back might help offset that.
From the day government education was instituted in 1852 in Massachusetts going forward, government education has always been by and for the state, period. Any history of the creation of the government school system going back to the 19th century demonstrates clearly that it was established on the model of Prussian education. And the goals were to make young children, and I'm essentially paraphrasing what was actually written as justifications for the creation of the government school system, to make young children servants of the state.
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's necessary. That's a necessary consequence of government support.
Let's go to the next question.
Well, has there ever been an education system that didn't do that?
I think the United States, much of United public education in the history of the United States, didn't do that. A servant of the state? No. Capable of operating within the state and living a good life? Yes.
Okay. You ready?
I'm Stephen Smith, and for purposes of this meeting, I have no affiliation. Professor Thompson, I appreciated your reference to Velvet Revolutions, Silk Revolutions, whatever that is. And Havel's great essay, The Power of the Powerless. But it seems that the communist regimes of Eastern Europe lack something that our present regime has, which is total control of information. I'm sure everyone in this room has had details recorded and put in some cyber storage unit somewhere. They know who we are, and they know where we live. This is one reason I thought the Benedict option was a little naive, because we can't retreat somewhere and be safe. They can come and get us. We may not yet have begun to fight, but neither have our opponents begun to fight. And Dr. Anton, you mentioned the Raj and its departure from India. Well, the difference between the Raj and our current woke regime is that the Raj was undergirded by fundamental decency and by the scrupulousness that our current masters don't have. You know, it could be that a mass of villagers in East Africa or South Asia could combine with their tools and weapons overcome a man-eating tiger. But who goes first? And unless we go together to fairly mass movement, will this work, what you suggest? Both of you?
So I'm tempted to answer with a short quote from another movie, half forgotten, called A Perfect Storm, but I like it. There's this fishing boat, and they're out in this horrible storm, and they finally think they're out, and one of the boats says, "Skip," to the captain. "You know, Skip, we made it." And George Clooney is the captain. At first he smiles, we're gonna live. And then sort of darkness comes over his face, and he just says, "She's not gonna let us out." I think that about the blob in a way. She's not gonna let us out. Like they're not gonna just let us go willingly. They're not gonna come to their senses and realize out of decency that, gee, we've really been bullies and this has gone too far. In terms of who goes first, that's an interesting question. So just sticking with civil disobedience, okay? Forget, you know, if you're going to, and from a military point of view, if you're going to attack a given position with a regiment, right, somebody's gonna get shot. Now the regiment may win, 80%, 90% may survive, but somebody's gonna die. Now, since we're not talking about a military, but we're talking about some kind of passive resistance to the regime, right? People are gonna go to jail. They're already putting people in jail right now for things that are really not crimes, or that are minor crimes, or that are crimes 1/1000th the intensity of stuff that their side gets away with routinely. So for us to take on the regime in this way, somebody's gonna go to jail. Probably a lot of people are gonna go to jail, unjustly, and have their lives ruined, and their financial, and their savings completely depleted, and to be just really blunt and dark for a second, some people are probably gonna die in jail. Are we ready for that? And who's it gonna be? Who's gonna make that charge first? And it's gonna be hard to convince anybody to go first, or to go at all. And the regime knows that, and I think that's one of the reasons why they're clamping down and making examples out of so many people. So I'm sorry to constantly harp on the bad, but let's be aware of what we're facing. We're not facing nice people who play by old rules and who want to be fair. I think we're facing bad people who want to be in power above all and are willing to do anything to maintain their power and are willing to do unjust and evil things to you and I in order to maintain their power. And the reason I say that is because they're doing it right now in front of our very eyes.
Which is precisely why the just walk away option, which is the one that I favor, I think recognizes that fact that you have identified, Michael. And it you know, in the end, will it succeed? I don't know. But given very few other options, I'm sticking to it.
I wanted to ask a question from Slido before you go. And it's about the pro-life movement and revolution. I wanted to try to amplify the question. It's the pro-life movement used the electoral process to get anti-Roe judges on the courts. So why does Anton insist that violent revolutions necessary? I know you weren't insisting that. I'm just reading the question necessarily. You know, the pro-life movement, disfavored by every powerful segment of our society, welcomed strangely with open arms or not with open arms by the Republican Party, kept at a distance by many Republican politicians, and yet after decades of making arguments, real arguments, has finally begun to succeed, at least on the court, and now is in the democratic process with the policy. Is there something to be drawn from the pro-life movement and how they proceeded in the face of tremendous opposition for such an important policy principle?
Sure, I'll take any victories wherever they can be gotten. And I'm very pleased that that happened, and I hope to see more such victories out of the court and so on. I think it would be naive to think that the courts from at any level, whether Supreme, appellate, district, you name it, are going to save us. They will win some more victories, but I mean, think of it this way, right? Imagine a price chart, a stock price chart, and the stock is liberty, right? So there's some spikes. It goes up sometimes. But if you look at the 50-year trend or the 100-year trend, it's down consistently. And if you look at just the 100-year trend, or let's say since the Warren Court, the trend in the courts is way down. To get back to where we were when all of this started is going to require hundreds of more victories like that. And if each one takes 50 years, where are we going to be? So I'm all for it. More wins, more lawsuits, more good judges, more. I just caution everybody against thinking that that's going to fundamentally turn things around in a short enough time frame while the regime is actively and speedily working to restrict liberty ever more.
So as a homeschooling father and a member of the Sons of the American Revolution, I agree generally with both presentations, but I also write and lobby on pieces of legislation and work on independent expenditure campaigns for and against candidates. So I want to drive the conversation to that kind of practical activity. One of the challenges that we see in Oklahoma, where all of the craziness is present in public schools, is that when transgender bathrooms come up, what people want, I mean, some people pull their kids out of schools, but what most people want is for us to go in and fix it. And so we do. We get the legislature to pass a law that says you can't do that in your schools. As pornographic curriculum is discovered in schools, that's going to be on the table for the next legislature. And we're going to write some laws, and I'm sure they will pass, that will prohibit those things. But part of what that does is give people a false sense of security that, and I've seen conservatives in Washington State try to put a measure on the ballot to require very specific civics curriculum. You've got to teach Locke and the Declaration, all these things. And I told them, why would you want Marxists to spend more time talking about all of these things, right? That is not going to achieve your results. They were not very happy, but they weren't successful either. And So I'm curious what you think about this at that granular level of legislative strategy and campaign strategy. Oklahoma is the reddest state in the country, but the average conservative there wants the public schools to succeed and thinks that these problems are little one-off flukes. They don't see the trend that Michael just described. So I'd love your response to that. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess my response, in fact, I think this is true in Oklahoma. We know it's true in Oklahoma, which is, how did that work out for you? Right? You pass all this anti-CRT legislation, and then, as you suggested, what happens is then conservatives go to sleep. They go to sleep. They think, victory, you know, we've saved the schools. And while it turns out the whole time CRT is still being taught, CRT is not going away. You can legislate it, you can try to legislate it out of the schools all you want. You will never get rid of it. It is there permanently. It is there because there is an education deep state. And the education deep state, at the heart of it, are the so-called ed schools, the teacher training institutions. And they are absolutely 100% top to bottom, they are driving CRT. Every single teacher who comes out of a teacher training institution is educated, indoctrinated in CRT. It's all they know. So why do conservative legislators think that they can legislate it out of existence? They can't. And the same is true with critical gender theory, right?
Here's what they could do, though, and they don't. I don't know why not yet. So I'm curious as to why there are a number of states that have Republican control in both houses of the state legislature, in some cases veto-proof majorities, they're not attacking the universities or these education schools. Why not just remove the necessity of an ed school credential to be a teacher? If you have a math degree, you can teach math, right? Start using state-level power, because as much as I'm totally for the homeschool movement, but I think we have to be realistic here and admit, at least this is my estimation, it's not a realistic option for the majority of the population who isn't equipped to do it, who doesn't have time, who needs that job to make money or whatever. Most parents are going to want a functioning school system that they can send their kids to because they just don't have the time, the inclination, the training, the patience, the whatever it is to homeschool their kids. I think the type of person who can do that is very admirable, but also somewhat rare. I don't know what it is as a percentage of the population, but it's not 50, and it's probably not 20. So they're going to have to be some kind of system to teach kids. The question is, what's it going to be? How is it going to be staffed and run? And in places where Republicans have power, they ought to be using that institutional power to shape these institutions. Again, agree totally. Don't just pass a CRT law and think that you're done and walk away. You got to be constantly riding herd on these places and figuring out what's going on and restaffing them and reshaping the culture. And that's a long generational fight, but I think that's a much better place for conservatives to be putting energies, let's say, over the next 10 or 20 years, than all the stuff that we obsess about at the federal level that is so hard to implement even if you can win a federal election and that gets undone as soon as you're out.
A question from Slido. Can we just walk away from other institutions of the administrative state? And it seems to me we've had talk of the Velvet Revolution. You know, one of the parts of the Velvet Revolution was the government had become so weak and impotent through trying to control everything that you could just sort of walk away from it and it collapsed. Is there any sign of that happening to the administrative state?
No, not that I mean, I don't, do you see any? I mean, I don't. I mean, I have some recent experience with the administrative state. I got chased out of it 4 years ago. It doesn't seem to be, I mean, it's incompetent and it's kind of bungling, but it's a weird combination of incompetent and bungling and so powerful and massively resourced that, you know, it looks like a behemoth from the outside and even from the inside. So it could be one of those things that, you know, the collapse surprises you. It sort of, when you, in hindsight, you may look at it and go, well, we saw all the signs and nobody put it all together. But right now I look at it and I go, it could be here for a little while. I don't see where the chinks in the armor are immediately.
Yeah, I don't see the deep state changing in any fundamental way. However, I do think in all kinds of areas outside of government that there are some signs of hope. I mean, clearly, I think the best sign of hope, as I've already made clear, is in K-12 education. But it's also now starting to happen at the university level in higher education. So we are now, just over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, we are seeing the creation of new colleges and universities. And this is what conservatives and libertarians need to be doing, and what they claim to do best, which is to think entrepreneurially. So rather than thinking of state solutions to problems, we ought to start thinking of private solutions to problems. We have seen the creation of the University of Austin in the last year. My friend Stephen Blackwood in Savannah, Georgia, has just launched Ralston College. I've heard of other colleges that have been launched in the last 2 years. The fact of the matter is, over the course of the next 10 or 15 years, a sizable number of colleges and universities are going to go out of business. Demographically, they cannot be sustained, and they are imploding as parents are looking for alternatives. I think about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a 150-acre college campus with 24 buildings in Vermont. And by buildings, I mean dormitories and administrative buildings, classroom buildings, theaters, athletic facilities, went on sale for $5 million. That is peanuts, right? So what we need to be doing is we really do need to be sort of starting, forget the deep state, forget the administrative state. It's there, it's not going away, we're not going to change it. So get outside of the system and start working and thinking entrepreneurially about creating new institutions from the ground up.
I'll let this be our last question.
Thank you. Daniel Lowenstein, and this will pick up on something that Michael Anton said just a couple of minutes or so ago. Professor Thompson, I wish you all success with this movement, and I hope, I mean, and the mothers who I guess are really the behind it, and I hope you succeed. I hope it spreads to the university more and really has an effect there. But you mentioned five things that are necessary in order to make this successful, and I want to suggest that there is an absolutely essential sixth thing, and it picks up on Professor Anton said, I think correctly, the vast majority of parents just aren't in a position to go off on their own and educate their children. So I would like to suggest that the sixth requirement is strong, massive institutional support for parents and families who want to educate their children outside the public schools. I'll assume for the sake of argument, because I don't want to get into the other argument that the two of you had, that this will, none of them will be governmental institutions, that they will be private. But it seems to me that it is absolutely necessary. So I'd like to ask you, A, do you agree with that? But also, if you do agree with it, could you talk for just a couple of minutes on what kind of support there might be and what kind of support there should be?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by support. Do you mean taxpayer-funded support?
No, I mean privately, whether it's charitable or, you know, just or entrepreneurial, but that something has to be there. They have to have an alternative if they take their kids out of school.
I think the majority of parents are not able or willing to homeschool their children. And even if they do, they really need institutional support, right. Some kind of support for that.
I think I'm more optimistic than you are on the ability and the willingness of parents to take responsibility for the education of their own children. But let me just give you two very quick anecdotal examples of how this can be done. In two of the poorest places in the entire world, in Hyderabad, India, and Lagos, Nigeria, where there is government-funded universal government schooling, 80% or somewhere between 70% and 80% of all children in the poorest slums of the entire world are privately educated. Now you might think to yourself, how is that possible? It's possible because in those countries, unlike in this country, they have removed all of the barriers to entry for the creation of schools. And what you've got now in these poor slums are thousands and thousands of small home schools where somebody puts a shingle out on their front stoop announcing the school. They bring in five students. And the fact of the matter is these desperately poor parents would much rather pull their kids out of the free government schools and have them educated in a small home school where they pay a minimal tuition, where parents are making $500 a year, right? So the fact of the matter is, if it can be done in Hyderabad, India, and Lagos, Nigeria, why can't it be done in the United States of America?
All right. Well, thank you. With that, we'll come to an end.